My brother Kip is going to read Exodus chapter 2, verse 1 through 10.
Thank you.
Wait, can you read that?
Exodus 2, 1 through 10.
The birth of Moses. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the river bank and saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to go get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water."
All right, thank you. I have really good help. Today, I want you to use your mind. I want you to picture all the terrifying places. Between earthquakes, mountains, floods, and lava flows, there are plenty of places to be afraid of. Now, think of all the windy roads, the rickety bridges, the lonely paths, the cemeteries, and Gothic homes. There are even more places to fear. Throw in prisons, mental institutes, dog pounds, and the dentist chair, and this world is downright horrifying. However, today, I want to argue that we aren't actually afraid of those types of places. Sure, you may fear for your bodily safety when you're at Walmart Black Friday, but today, I want to talk about the places that we fear the most. I want to argue that there are places that are scarier than the pictures I've just painted for you. I want to argue that sometimes the scariest place of all is our very own skin. Sometimes we literally want to be anyone else. Picture this. I'm 16 years old, and I'm new in town, and I'm a sophomore, and I'm playing football, and it's Friday night, and the score is tied, and it's my first game to get to start, and I'm playing tight end. And I had already caught 2 balls that night. And it's 4th and a mile. And the clock is winding down, and the coach calls timeout. And 22 eyes are fixed on him, begging him to say those 3 little words, "Go for it." And he says them. And we scrunch in. And we're waiting to hear the play call that we want to remember the rest of our lives. We all want to grow old, and we want to tell the story of the time that we went for it on 4th and long. We won the game, and we saved our homecoming. So coach calls the play, and he looks right at me, and he says, "Run a post." And he looks at the split end, and he says, "Run a flag." And then he tells the quarterback to throw it to me. But the last thing that I hear is the split end saying, "Run a flag." "Got it." And those words stuck in my head. So I run the route, and I look back into the backfield, and the quarterback's getting sacked. And he's looking for me, but he's looking in the wrong zip code because I ran the wrong route. And the next thing that I know, the coach is screaming at me about not knowing the difference between a flag and a post. And the game ends in a tie. And I basically didn't get thrown another ball the rest of the season. I could still see the coach throwing his headset down, and the locker room after the game was tense. Or what about the time when I was in middle school and I asked a girl to go to the junior high dance with me, and she literally doesn't speak to me the entire evening. I found out later on that her mother basically made her go with me. And I still feel this cringy feeling thinking about that awkward night to this day. And in college, things don't improve much. I was invited to a scholarship banquet, and there was a typo in the notes that the speaker had. And what I thought was my group was called up to the front, and then they call every name, and they hand everyone there their little certificate one by one until eventually it's just me, and I'm standing there. And then the speaker looks at me and says, "We don't have one for you. I don't think you are supposed to be here." I felt so stupid. I turned so red. But let's tell the truth. Even now, I'm trying to be real. I haven't touched on true pain. What about the pain we feel when we are just flat out wrong? What about when we're the ones who said the hurtful words? We're the ones that acted out. We didn't treat people right. We slammed the door. We told the lie. And I'm not talking about when you were wronged, though you probably have been. I'm talking about when you have failed. The situations that we rightfully fear because we frankly don't know how to be. What does it look like when we don't know how to be us? When we aren't comfortable in our own skin? When things go completely off the rails and we can't find our way back? What do we do when we seem to have no purpose, no plan, and no place? Today, I want to talk about someone who was born into a backdrop of violence. One of the most powerful men in the world becomes fearful, so the edict is handed down. All Hebrew male babies are to be cast in the Nile to their deaths. So even before Moses is born, he is feared by Pharaoh. And not just Moses, but his entire generation. And I guess that you could say that technically Amram and Jochebed followed the law. They did throw their male baby into the Nile. They just put him into a basket first. And so after birth, the Bible's going to tell us that Moses is a fine child. And maybe that means he's healthy or cute, but all babies are cute, right? But I know this, he has potential. And his parents can see that he is worthy of life and of a future. And I also know that the powers of this world don't value life and justice and freedom. And Pharaoh was fine as long as this group of people could be controlled and be enslaved by his government. But what if they become too large and they desire freedom? He begins to look at all these young lives as a threat to his status. Pharaoh and his ilk do not see life as something that is to be valued and sacred. They divide people up by race and class, and they cling to their power. Never let that be said of us, that we see life as a problem. Then in a story that only God could call forth from this violence and unfairness, Moses is raised with one foot in the quarters of the slaves and one foot in the palace. His mother is actually paid to nurse him. But soon he is raised as a prince of Egypt. Exodus 2:10 says that he became the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Then look at what she names him, Moses, because I drew him out of the water. She makes herself the hero. Never mind that her father's policies put him in the water. Never mind the cleverness and the braveness of the midwives and of Moses' family to defy the law. Never mind the sovereignty of God. In arrogance, she says, "Here's this little boy that magically popped out of the water that I saved." God uses even arrogant, powerful people in ways they just don't understand. And so Moses grows up in power and privilege as royalty. We're still in chapter 2. Let's pick up the story in 11. It says that one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were. Did you catch how he's talking about Hebrews here? were and watched them at their hard labor. Moses goes from being oppressed to being privileged. He went from a life as what he would have been a slave to one of a prince. However, in his core, Moses identifies with the people of God. He looks like Egypt. He dresses like Egypt. He speaks like Egypt. His name is given by an Egyptian princess. But when he lays down at night, he knows the truth. He lacks peace. He's troubled. His conflict is centered on his core identity. And he asks the question, who am I and how do I live this out? And so he goes to check on his people. And you know the story. He's there and an Egyptian slave master starts beating this Israelite. And Moses identifies with the Israelite. He says that the Egyptian was beating one of his own people. And all of Moses' simmering doubts and fears and anger boil up. And Moses kills the Egyptian. And then he hides the body in the sand. And this is when Moses' life seems to go off the rails. His heart says, I'm a Hebrew. And he has this strong sense of justice. However, Hebrews are slaves. So while in his heart he's trying to stand with the people of God, by his actions, he's still standing with Pharaoh because of the way he uses violence. Does that sound like us? In our hearts, we want to raise up Jesus as king, but I can pull up my Facebook right now and I can find people that are waging nasty words of war in the name of the Prince of Peace. And we may leave the church, but sometimes we drive and we live like the sons of hell. It's what Moses does. Moses is struggling with who he is and how to live that out. The very next day, there's two Hebrews, and they're beefing. They're having a conflict. And Moses goes in and tries to settle it. And one of them says, are you going to kill me too? Suddenly, the tension that Moses has felt his whole life between being a Hebrew and a prince of this world comes to a head. And Pharaoh wants to kill him, and the Hebrews don't really respect him. He's not part of either camp. And so he flees. And this starts Act 2 of his story. Moses flees to Midian, and this starts what must have felt like the lost years. However, Moses carries with him this strong sense of justice. In Midian, the first thing he does is he sits by a well. And soon, a group of sisters are going to show up to water their flocks. And then there's some men who show up with their flocks, and they scatter the flocks of the sisters. And Moses is going to rescue the girls. And he's going to say, no, they were here first. And later, these girls, they go home and they talk to their dad. And guess what they tell their dad? They say, Dad, an Egyptian came to save us. Even on the run from Pharaoh, that label sticks to him. Ever try to run from your past and it just follows you? How much do you want to bet that Moses said, I'm done trying to save the world. No more conflict for me. And definitely no more Egypt for me. So he flees. And he barely gets out of town. And boom. Before he knows it, he's back in conflict with a bunch of violent men. And that same label sticks. Egyptian. Moses may have left home, but really nothing has changed. He is haunted by his past. He's still fundamentally the same person with the same set of problems. Depending on which scholar that you believe, Moses is on the land in Midian for 40 years. And we know the story. He's tending the sheep for his father-in-law, Jethro, who we're told is the priest of Midian. So even in his own family, Moses is not the religious leader. And he's out in the wilderness, and God shows up. And we all know the story, the burning bush, and God calls him by name. And he says it twice. He says, Moses, Moses. God is calling him back to his story. Moses, you are drawn from the water. And then he says that famous phrase, take off your shoes because you're standing on holy ground. And we tend to focus on that part of the conversation, and we talk about the holiness of God. And I would love to do that. But today, I want to focus on the next phrase in Exodus 3:6. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Moses may have been drawn out of the water, but God's plan for Moses goes back hundreds of years. He places Moses in that larger story. Pharaoh's daughter may have plucked him out of the water, named him, and raised him, but God made him, and only in God will he find his true self. His name may tell him where he came from, that he was drawn from the water, but God is about to tell him where he is going. And God reveals that he has seen the suffering of the Israelites, and that he is sending Moses to Pharaoh to free them. And I love how God doesn't dwell on the past. He doesn't give a pep talk to Moses. God sees a problem, and he wants Moses to go and deliver the people, period. Now, in his younger days, I think Moses would have jumped at this opportunity. He seems like a natural fit for the job. Moses has this sense of justice. He jumped in, and he tried to save the slave. He met his wife when he rescues her and her sisters from these abusive men. But Moses is in his old age now. He's possibly 80, and maybe he's unsure of himself. Maybe he's lost his way. And look at what he asked God. He's given his mission, and 11 says, "But Moses said to God, 'Who am I?'" Moses says, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" Moses is trying to figure out who he is. Am I Hebrew? Am I Egyptian? Am I a felon at large still? Am I a prince? Am I a slave? Am I a Midianite? Who am I? Moses has lost his identity, and it is interfering with his purpose. I want to say that again. Moses is so stuck on labeling himself and his qualifications that he cannot participate in God's plan. Church, stop thinking about yourself. Stop thinking about your past. Stop wondering if you are qualified. If God says go, you're qualified. Stop caring if this group or that group doesn't really like you. Do not let yesterday's mistakes keep you from today's opportunities to serve God. Because listen to how God is going to answer the question. Moses is going to ask, "Who am I?" Guess what God says? He doesn't tell him Egyptian or Hebrew or slave or free, criminal. He doesn't use any of those labels. God says, "I will be with you." Moses, it doesn't matter who you are. Church, that's good news. Egyptian, slave, free, prince, criminal. Moses is all of these things, and God says it doesn't matter because I am with you. And listen to the rest of this. He says, "And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." He says, "I'm bringing you back here to this place with the people." Moses was never meant to simply free the people from bondage. He was meant to lead them back to God. This world is full of prisons. We can be in bondage to shopping, to food, to hobbies, to lust, to laziness, to pleasing men. And God says to not only lead people out of bondage, but back to him. And Moses is worried still. He's like, "God, what if they don't know you? What is your name?" And I love how Moses starts the conversation by asking God, "Who am I?" And God steers the conversation into telling him that God is the I am who I am. Do you see the twist of words there? And so Moses is called to do something he never wanted to do. He's called to go back to his past, the place of failure, the place where he never quite felt at home, the place where he had committed a murder, the place where his people had been wronged, the place where he was rejected. He's called back, and boy, is he fearful. Literally half of chapter 4 is Moses and God arguing about how Moses is the wrong guy for the job. "But God, what if they don't believe me?" God says, "Okay, what's that in your hand?" He says, "A staff." He says, "Throw it down." Shh. Turns into this horrifying snake. And at this point, I'm out. I'm done with this mission. I hate snakes. He says, "Pick it up." He grabs it by the tail. That takes faith. Goes back to being a staff again. He says, "I've got another one for you. Take your hand, put it to your cloak, take it out. Ah, it's diseased, leprosy. Okay, put it back in, cure." He says, "Okay, I've got one more for you. If they still don't believe you, take some water from the Nile, pour it out, instant blood. Looks like a horror movie right away. And Moses still persists. He says, God, I can't do this. I'm a stutterer. And at this point, it says that God's anger burns against Moses. Moses is just wearing God out. And God says, fine, your brother is on his way. He can speak. And so Moses returns back home. And this kicks off Act 3 of his story. And Moses goes back to the place we fear the most. Moses goes back home. He goes back to a place of failure. And he must convince the Hebrews. And then he has to do battle with Pharaoh and his magicians, Jannes and Jambres. And we know the story. God's going to send 10 plagues. And that's going to culminate in Moses leading the Hebrews out of bondage. And that story becomes the defining and most important story of the Israelites. And this act is later celebrated in a feast of remember, it's called what? Passover, right? So, what are the takeaways? First, I think that Moses must have felt like he wasted a lot of years. But God used them all. He used his years at his mother's knee to give him a love for the people of God. He used his years as a prince to give him access to Pharaoh later on in life. He even used his years as a shepherd in Midian as a training ground for shepherding 12 tribes in the wilderness for 40 long years. God uses all of it. And he does the same thing for you and for I. We have no wasted years. God can use them all. The second takeaway is Moses gets comfortable in his own skin when he finally obeys God. I hope you have time to go back and read the whole story and see that Moses is complex as a character. He vacillates between being arrogant and angry on one hand and then timid and fearful afterwards. He has this sense of justice that builds to rashness when it isn't tempered with obedience to God. And then he seems to be racked by doubt and guilt. And God works with Moses through all of this. But it doesn't come together until Moses obeys God. The third one is, God's timing is not our timing. I can imagine the decades Moses spent in the palace, the decades he spent in the wilderness, and then think about the centuries that the Israelites were in bondage. And it is hard for us to weigh on the unfolding of God's perfect plan. God takes a long view that we can't possibly think of. Now, this morning, we did something that's very special. We passed around some bread and some grape juice. And directly, we traced this meal back to Jesus and to his followers. But they traced this meal back to Egypt. See, Moses is with us still today. And this meal that we partake of is so central to who we are. It's one of the reasons why we meet. And the ceremony that we do has a key phrase that in a lot of congregations, including here, is emblazoned on the table. Do this in remembrance of me. What if you were one of the 12? What if you were there when Jesus washed the feet, broke the bread, and poured the wine? Would you really want to remember that night? I think that it would be a bittersweet memory because that was the night that his closest friends let him down. One of these guys outright denies him, and most all of the rest of them run away in the dead of night. They abandon their leader. Yet, other than Judas, they all returned to that meal. Week in and week out, they show back up and they teach other people to do the same. And I think we all know why. The point of the meal is the faithfulness of God, not the faithlessness of man. This could be a feast that is coated with bitterness, shame, and failure. But this is not a memorial to human failure and human sin. It's a testament to the sovereignty of God. And here's the good news. No. Here's the great news. God redeems it all. There's a song by Bleachers that the chorus goes like this. I didn't know that I was lonely until I saw your face. I want to get better. I didn't know that I was broken until I wanted to change. I want to get better. I want to get better. Today, maybe you took the bread and you drank the cup, and all that you can see is your own failure. Maybe you are asking, who am I that I should get this cup and this loaf? God answers your question. It doesn't matter who you are. It matters that God is the great I am and that he is with you. God is calling us from the wilderness. He wants to redeem the years. He wants to call you by name. He has a purpose for your life. And if the place you've come to fear the most is your own skin, he wants to clothe you in his son. If you have needs at the church, come as we stand and sing.